Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for tuning in to another episode of Rec Room Radio. For this episode, we have with us Pseudomastix, who is an avid enjoyer of philosophy, and will be discussing a Kierkegaard 101 course, where we touch on the brief and surface layer issues of or ideas of Kierkegaard and extend further down. His qualifications is that he has an extended bachelor's at the University of Queensland in Australia and is currently pursuing a master's at the University of New England. I wish him best of luck in that, and I'm privileged to have him on the show. Hey, Pseudomastix, you want to introduce yourself?
Hello, all. I'm Pseudomastix. You can call me Sam if you want. I've been studying philosophy for a number of years now. I have thoroughly enjoyed every part of it, and although I would consider myself probably a layman scholar of Kierkegaard, I have read quite a bit of his works and have been enjoying my own personal studies of him so far.
Yeah, it's glad to have you on. And I guess for our first question, in particular of philosophers, what role does Kierkegaard have to play with you personally when you were introduced to him? Has he influenced any of your views?
So I was introduced to Kierkegaard when I was doing my bachelor's, and it was quite a strange experience. We had a grad student come in, and he was playing a bunch of different characters, and it was quite surreal. He was introducing himself under different names. He was explaining different contradictory ideas and topics. And basically, at the end of the seminar, he explained this is effectively what Kierkegaard is doing in his works, because Kierkegaard wrote, obviously, under many pseudonyms and played effectively different characters within his books. He wrote, for example, Fear and Trembling under the guise of a man who was not a religious man, even though Kierkegaard was himself deeply religious. So it was a surreal introduction to Kierkegaard. In respect to how he's affected probably the rest of my philosophical education, at least here in Australia, we study existentialism pretty much all the time in philosophy here. It's one of the more popular schools of thought that is alive and well in Australian universities. And Kierkegaard, as kind of being seen as the father of existentialism, is quite admired. You would be very hard to find somebody studying philosophy in Australia who has not at least heard of Kierkegaard or let alone read him.
All right. Thank you very much on that. And also with us today is my co-host of Rec Room Radio, good friend Hazy Dialects. It's good to see him join us. How you doing, Hazy?
I'm doing pretty well, and it's always great to have a long spiel and yap session about philosophy. One thing in particular that stands out to me about Frederick, and mostly a lot of philosophers, is this othering that they can sometimes do by using other pseudonyms. More importantly, what those pseudonyms are in service of. Socrates was one of these individuals who desired to help people, inform them of the ways to live an earnest and moralistic life. However, similar to, well, the words that are often used as a rebuttal, who gives you the right to, who makes you the moral authority, that othering could be a way of enabling somebody to ask you, similarly as a mortal, what gives you that right to do so? And in that question, it may be hard to invoke or endow someone with those moralistic lens to evaluate things critically. Thus, the questioning must become an internal evaluation. And with all that asked, I have to then speak about how these pseudonyms were in service of getting people to invoke that out of them. And that would be the question I would like to ask our guest today.
Sure. So the pseudonyms, I think, that Kierkegaard presents with his works, they do a lot to kind of set the perspective of each one of his works. So I think it's very easy to take a work written concerning atheism and assume that this work, if it is written by an atheistic person, as it's going to be kind of supportive, or if it's written about faith, it's going to be negative. What Kierkegaard can kind of do with adopting pseudonyms in his work is kind of suspend this level of kind of presupposition within his works. Instead, by having effectively multiple names he can author under, he can kind of assume different roles, much in the same way that Plato kind of in the Socratic dialogues in writing about them can construct characters as presenting different views. So, in a sense, although the pseudonyms of Kierkegaard are important for establishing kind of how these books are to be read, I think they're much more important in kind of a meta-philosophical discussion concerning perspective. This is incredibly important for Kierkegaard's work later on, considering that he's kind of like the progenitor of this subjective-objective distinction between knowledge.
Yes, definitely. And something I forgot to mention earlier, but for our audience as well, they may not be as well endowed in philosophical terms, or how they like to call it, jargon, as we are. So every now and then I'll stop by and ask you, what does a certain term mean? And to get it right off the rip, I'd like to ask, we mentioned Kierkegaard in existentialism. Could you explain to a layman what is existentialism and why it's so important for Kierkegaard?
So existentialism, and in the broadest sense of the word, is this notion that the essences that we encounter within philosophy are not actually definitive ontological substances, but are rather kind of synthetic apparitions that we kind of prescribe onto things. So things kind of are before they are given their essence, and we are the ones apparently that give them their essence. This is kind of a deconstruction of meaning that kind of occurred throughout the Enlightenment, when people started to doubt what things like man were, and they started conceiving of different natures of man. Kierkegaard kind of takes this to the ultimate extreme when he applies this kind of reasoning to everything. And so in a sense, this notion that we kind of have a concrete meaning or a concrete existence that has a particular purpose becomes very obscured and blurry. This is kind of like the quintessential essence of existentialism, is that we do not necessarily know what or where we are or what we should do. It is this prevailing sense of anxiety about our existence. You know, what are we? What are we supposed to do? What should I do? How can I know what to do, in a sense? This is probably what I would introduce as a notion of existentialism.
And okay, thank you. And my follow-up to that was something you mentioned also. Can you explain metaphysics to the audience briefly?
So metaphysics is a discussion concerning the nature of reality. So there are many different branches of metaphysics. There is ontology, which wants to study the being. There is, in a sense, phenomenology, which is the study of our relation to reality through experience. But effectively, metaphysics is the study of kind of what is, in a sense, what exists, what is existence, you know, what is a thing in the most broadest sense.
All right, thank you. And Hazy, didn't mean to interrupt you earlier. Were you going to add on to that?
The question I was going to add on to that is, you spoke about this evaluation, and usually in this evaluation is in service of finding truth. But there's a strong delineation between truth as it's commonly understood in Parliament and modern day versus normally it's one second. I will just serve it up to my co-host, just to let him talk for a minute.
Yeah, sure. If it'd be okay, we can move on then to another question I want to have in regards to Kierkegaard. How can you describe the concept of the leap of faith in philosophy? And which one of Kierkegaard's works does that come from?
So the leap of faith kind of is really presented best in Fear and Trembling. And the conception behind the leap of faith is that reason cannot itself kind of provide its own, it cannot provide justification for kind of like the infinite values that are embodied in religion, Kierkegaard believes. He doesn't believe, like the old scholastic philosophers such as Aquinas, that we can simply use reason to come to know God and come to know what is right. Rather, Kierkegaard argues that instead we kind of have to take these religious judgments or values on a leap of faith. We kind of have to just assume they're right with no justification outside of some presuppositional itself belief. And it's quite a powerful thing within Kierkegaard's work, this leap of faith, because he believes this is kind of the only way that we can get to the highest sphere of existence. So in Kierkegaard, there are three spheres of existence. There is the aesthetic sphere, the ethical sphere, and the religious sphere. And he really only believes that only through this this leap of faith, this display of kind of utmost acceptance of some what I would probably call dogma, but what would he would kind of call as a kind of tenet of existence. It is only through that we can kind of come to truly know the infinite.
Okay, and something I found interesting about Kierkegaard I want to get your thoughts on is he shares some commonalities of other philosophers around that time, such as Friedrich Nietzsche, and I believe we spoke about this earlier. It's common online circles for people to make the claim that Kierkegaard is one face of the same coin and Nietzsche is on the opposite side. What are your thoughts on that claim, and do you feel like there's some validity in it, or is it overinflated?
On one sense, I do believe that there are definite connections between them. Both Kierkegaard and Nietzsche are wanting to discuss the problem of a kind of meaningless existence, or rather an existence whose meaning is not known or graspable through reason. They kind of start to differ from each other with their conclusions. So they kind of have, at least in some respect, the same starting point, which is that we exist. We don't really know what we're supposed to do. We have this kind of ability or capacity to use reason, but we're not sure if reason can provide us with the knowledge that we seek. So where do we go from here? Nietzsche kind of takes a much more negative approach and says, well, rather than try to presuppose this religious sphere and try to attempt to find it using either reason or faith, we should negate all of that and instead deny the religious life. So instead, we should kind of go back towards kind of what he would probably call the vital life, the life in itself. Whereas Kierkegaard, in a strange way, takes the opposite approach. He says, well, if we can't truly use reason to kind of know the infinite, to know the transcendent truth of the world, we kind of have to just find a way to live with that. And the best way to live with that is through the leap of faith.
One of the things I notice about the leap of faith is, well, Kierkegaard does acknowledge and accept that faith is drastically different than a belief system, which a belief system is the repeated measure of having some way or somehow of validating one's belief in something, as in a way to validate it in of itself, like knowing for certain or having some strong reason to believe in it. If I were to say that my hoodie is in my closet, I can check, I can go over there and be certain of these ideas. However, with the faith, there is no absolute certainty. And the prescription at that point is to say that there necessitates a certain level of blind faith. And I think that's an interesting distinction to be made, because in that direction, at least how I interpret it, is that with that, there is something that is immovable in terms of your values and systems and beliefs, at least in terms of how important it is to abide by your certain ethics through this book, this religious book, is that there's something supposed to be unmovable, something that cannot be broken, and that's the faith. Because the faith doesn't operate over this rigorous system, it is a strong adherence to it beyond some logical foundation of justifiable steps. So I thought that was interesting about
I think the adherence of faith is a very strange thing in Kierkegaard's work, because Kierkegaard on one hand seems to present that people who are truly faithful, who he calls knights of faith, faith kind of comes easy to them in some sense. There's some quality about people who are truly faithful that kind of allows them to be comfortably faithful and to be comfortable with their resignation of faith. You know, the people who truly kind of put everything up to God and say, God, my heart is yours. You are in control of my life. I will do whatever you bid of me. That's something that's very hard to do with somebody who kind of lacks that quality. People who have doubts, people who have anxiety, will find it increasingly hard to kind of find this level of faith, maybe, perhaps is the better word. Because there are different kinds of, or not different kinds, rather, there are different levels of faith for Kierkegaard. We kind of take a lot of things on granted for faith, but to take the most important things about us, you know, who we are, what we ought to do, what life means, to take that on faith is something particularly hard, Kierkegaard thinks.
Yeah, but that's what's in the beauty of it, I'd say, because something that I find him distinct and different, especially from, like, let's say the scholastics, like St. Thomas Aquinas, Aquinas believed heavily in we can prove God's existence through logic reasoning, while Kierkegaard is more ambivalent in that and says, well, that's the point of taking faith. You have to take that leap. It never was intended to be easy. But that's something I definitely find unique about him and his works.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Kierkegaard is, at least in the wake of the Enlightenment, with the effects of, you know, Hegel, Fichte, Kant, Schelling on the process of discussing, you know, knowing God through reason. Kierkegaard is a kind of like the natural response, you know, because after the Enlightenment, everyone was kind of so convinced that, well, God is kind of not truly knowable through our capacity of reason, not really in the same way that we might come to know other things. So really, it was kind of a catch-22 for Kierkegaard. He either needed to accept the Enlightenment and kind of accept that we had no rational capacity to know the infinite, or he had to take his other route, which is to say, well, even if we don't know it, we can kind of take it on faith. That's not to say, though, that Kierkegaard thinks that faith is kind of a substandard way of knowing. He actually presents in his work that faith is kind of like a superior way of coming to know God, because he thinks it's only through faith that we actually get to know God's characteristics truly. When we think of knowing God rationally through argumentation or through the discussion of metaphysics, say, like Aquinas, we kind of get a very systematized version of God. God is, you know, this subject that has particular predicates like necessity, perfection, goodness, etc. But for Kierkegaard, the God you encounter through the leap of faith is so much more than that. He's kind of everything all in one. He's so much greater. Maybe a better way to describe it is that rather than simply ascribing the mere predicate of perfection or the predicate of goodness, through the act of faith, he writes, you can come to kind of experience goodness or experience perfection, or at least have a small grasp of it in a much more visceral way than reason could ever hope to give us.
I would also add on to that is that not only did Kierkegaard believe that faith was extremely important in the belief, but he also believed in the individual having a strong attachment in the personal relationship, often decrying the notion of the mob of faith, just people blindly believing in faith. And blindly believing in faith is quite different than a faith in God, that the personal relationship is extremely important to know what it means to uphold those beliefs. And with doing that, with that internal evaluation, will your relationship be stronger, nigh insurmountable to how people commonly relate to God? Whereas there is an adherence to it, but there's no meaningful nature to the abiding of the gospel.
Yeah, I think the personal relationship between the individual and God is kind of a centerpiece in Kierkegaard's work, especially in Fear and Trembling. The whole discussion of how Abraham could be a knight of faith is specifically because he has a kind of personal connection with God. God came down and privately kind of communicated with him in, if you could call that communication, said, you know, you are to give me Isaac. And it is only through the kind of this intimate act that on one hand, Abraham could kind of come to know God, but on the also, he can also come to doubt God. And it is through this kind of God appearing to Abraham and then appearing as something not like God, which is that of a being which is telling you to give your son to him, that Abraham can kind of find faith.
I like that a lot, especially if we look at stories like the Book of Exodus, for example, when you had Moses trembling before the burning bush and awestruck of the power of God as described. And it in that, I remember there was a lecture I've done, if I could find it, I'll link it, but Kierkegaard was specifically discussing his works on that too, and like the nature of God between man. But a question I wanted to ask you, Sudo, is Kierkegaard is undeniably influential Who would you say would be some of the people who influenced him, though? And for what reason? Why?
Kierkegaard is probably most influenced by Hegel. And it's specifically because of Hegel's discussion concerning systems in a strange particular way. Also, his discussion of aesthetics. On one hand, Kierkegaard is kind of one of the biggest critics of Hegel. His discussion of a suspension of a teleological suspension of the ethical kind of stands in direct kind of opposition to Hegel's discussion of aesthetics. But in a sense, he's kind of like the one of the inheritors of Hegel's work. There's not really a way that you can kind of, at least in modern conceptions of philosophy, overcome Hegel. He sublates everything so much that any kind of disagreement with him is already some form of an agreement of him in another way. If I was to say who he kind of best represents, it would either be Hegel or, strangely enough, Schleiermacher. Schleiermacher is a German philosopher who wrote extensively about theology and theology specifically in the wake of the Enlightenment, how we could kind of come to know God if we kind of take the presupposition that reason is incapable of knowing God. It's really those two people, I think, that he probably would be most affected by.
Okay. And my follow-up would be, well, I know a little bit of this because one of my all-time favorite philosophers, Gabriel Marcel, was heavily influenced by Kierkegaard. But who else would you say along that catalog was also influenced by him?
Quite easily, the main big three people I would say who are influenced by Kierkegaard are Martin Heidegger, Jean-Paul Sartre, and Albert Camus. Kierkegaard has a particular conception which is central to his work, which is the idea of angst or anxiety. And Kierkegaard says that this mood that we have is really indicative of human existence, because anxiety isn't just fear, because fear has an aboutness about something. Fear is about a particular outcome. Anxiety occurs when we don't know what the outcome is. It's an uncertainty of some particular end. And there's a few things that can be drawn from this, actually. So Kierkegaard speaks about how anxiety kind of gives us a real view into our nature as free beings. It is when I stand on top of on the edge of a cliff, I get anxiety because I, at that moment, recognize that I have the capacity to jump off the cliff. I could jump off the cliff, and you know, I would effectively kind of kill myself, but I have the freedom to do that. And this freedom of what I can do at any moment makes us, well, anxious. Heidegger takes this and runs with it and says that this is actually a transcendental proof of our free will. The fact that we can be anxious of something proves that we must be able to make a free choice concerning these things. This also discussion of, despite the fact that we can have a free choice, that these choices may still be meaningless, forms the basis for the idea of the absurd, which we find in people like Camus. And then also with Jean-Paul Sartre takes this idea of anxiety and takes it and runs with it in a similar way as Heidegger does.
Okay, thank you. Hazy, would you like to ask any questions along this topic?
One of the questions that was going to be asked at the beginning, but I had some technical difficulties, but I think I can ask it now. What do you think is a very important delineation between truth and how Kierkegaard talks about it? Because on one hand, in modern day, often people say they are in pursuit of truth. However, on a podcast we were recently on, I often said that that's kind of a post-hoc rationale. Most of the time period, there's a bit of a feeling or value system, and we work backwards from our value we should believe it to be. Start erecting systems to understand how strongly we can defend those ideas in the public sphere or in the public zeitgeist. And therefore, people typically understand truth and they conflate the two that often Kierkegaard delineated with, the subjective truth and the objective truth. However, there's a difference of meaning within those two experiences. And would you like to elaborate on that?
Sure. So Kierkegaard was he's explained as being kind of the source of this distinction between subjective and objective truths. I don't think that that's necessarily like a correct way to put it. He's certainly the one who spoke about it viscerally the most. But I do believe that it actually had its sources in people prior to him. For Kierkegaard, the truth of something can relate to two things. It can either relate to kind of the appearances that you yourself perceive. In that case, something could be true in reference to your appearance of a thing. And it can be true irrespective of your appearances, which is kind of true in relation to what is being perceived, like the actual ontological thing. So in that respect, one would say that one can be true subjectively, which is something that is true for me or as it appears to me, and something can be true objectively, which is it's true irrespective of whether or not it appears to me as such. This was his big kind of criticism of what came out of the Enlightenment, because a very large part of the Enlightenment was a kind of battle over the idea of is truth subjective or objective. Famously, Kant himself kind of argued that objective truth and subjective truth are kind of nested as one and the same, but that we can't have a notion of objective truth because, you know, the thing in itself, the ontological entity, he doesn't believe is cognizable. That being said, it doesn't play as much of a role as you think for Kierkegaard, because when he discusses truth, he kind of usually discusses it in relation to faith, at least in Fear and Trembling. And the notion of what is true and what isn't true is kind of, in a way, not brought up. And I think that's for a good reason, because the Knight of Faith doesn't necessarily need to converse with truth. They kind of already possess it in some strange way. When one kind of encounters the infinite, or kind of has a notion of what is truly there through the infinite, they no longer kind of need to discuss what is true or what isn't true. They just have the truth, so to speak.
That's something I always found interesting. And going earlier to what you're saying, a lot of his critiques for post-Enlightenment era, I would argue it's pretty multifaceted, because he covered a lot of bases from, like we said, an emphasis on objectivity. He speaks of a loss of individuality, and something I find fascinating that we haven't brought up yet, but the alienation, despair he sees in society, where he characterizes a sense of, like, you know, we're just alone. Like, he believes the focus on reason and progress could lead to a sense of meaningless and emptiness as individuals lose touch of their authentic selves. I wanted to know your thoughts on that. Do you feel Kierkegaard was correct in categorizing a critique of the post-Enlightenment that way? Do you feel like it was overblown or otherwise brushed over?
I think it's a bit of a misnomer, because I think Kierkegaard writes that the authentic way that we kind of live is in despair in a strange particular way. The way that we normal humans go about our lives is one of anxiety. We are uncertain of absolutely everything. And unless you are kind of like a knight of faith, like Kierkegaard hopes that we all become, there's no real way to live any other way. We kind of are doomed to anxiety. Now, it's quite a depressing matter, but Kierkegaard thinks that it's actually it's quite healthy to kind of become situated in anxiety, because it's only through anxiety that you can actually kind of encounter what is and isn't authentic. When you kind of recognize your own freedom and recognize that you are in control of your life and that you yourself kind of have to pick who you are and what to believe, you know, I guess that's kind of the quintessential idea of a leap of faith, is that it's kind of you jumping, so to speak, which I think, as far as I'm aware, differs a bit different from the traditional conception of, you know, soteriology or Christianity.
Well, let's dive a little bit deeper with that then. So how would Kierkegaard's concept of anxiety relate to his understanding of human existence and freedom? Is it only just a leap of faith, or can we go deeper with that? Is there anything else?
No, so it has more to do with the discussion of how we are free. So for Kierkegaard, we kind of truly are free in the most basic sense, in that we can decide to do whatever we want to do. And that kind of allows us to be anxious, because we are, in a sense, in control of ourselves. And because we are in control of ourselves, but at the same time, we don't know what to do with ourselves, that's what kind of leads to the dilemma that you kind of described before with the Enlightenment. I think it's a very hard thing to kind of grasp, this notion of freedom in relation to Kierkegaard's leap of faith. For Kierkegaard, the leap of faith is at once an expression of freedom, but it's also kind of a surrendering of freedom, because you're kind of, in a sense, saying, I am free to choose whatever I want to do, but I am choosing to abide in, you know, God. I'm going to do whatever he says. So even though I have the complete capacity to do whatever I want, I'm going to use that capacity to instead only do what is required of me by God, or do whatever God asks me to do. So it's kind of a weird paradox, in a sense. You are using your freedom, in a sense, to kind of surrender your freedom to God, and instead do what God says yourself.
Almost like a weird spin. We're getting into divine command theory territory, so let's see how long we can hold that off, though. Hazy, yeah, do you have any other questions you want to add on?
In the building to the leap of faith, something I thought was interesting is the stages that he believes humanity often operates in. There's the ecstatic stage, where it's just cathartic, it's just debauchery, it's living for satisfaction. This is like the base level, the red, the lowest form of living one's life. And then there's the ethical stage, living by principles, and adherence of some framework of morality. And then he believes that the highest form is a devotion to living, or at least abiding by, a religious text. What is your thought about that in terms of these stages and the conclusion there?
So these three spheres of existence that Kierkegaard purports, he kind of takes from idea of Hegel. So Hegel has this notion that we have an aesthetic life, for starters, which is unprincipled but kind of reactive. So I go through my life, and if something causes me pain, I avoid it, and if something causes me joy, I, you know, revel in it. And then we move on to the ethical stage, where we apply the principles, you know, if something causes pain, then avoid, you know, that's a principle. And through the construction of principles, we find things like duty or honor, or I guess in a weird abstract sense, kind of qualified or quantified goodness. But instead, Kierkegaard has the third stage, or the third sphere of existence, which is the religious sphere. And in this, you kind of get away from the notion of principles, because principles themselves always kind of contain their own negations. You know, the idea that one ought to obey God is accompanied with the idea that one ought not obey God, because, well, if every principle must have a negation in some respect, and choosing between these two principles, whether the antecedent or the negation, requires kind of a third principle, which is where we actually get a dialectic from. Instead, the religious sphere, Kierkegaard sees as kind of the abolishment of a dialectic. We no longer need a dialectic once we encounter the religious sphere, because there is no need to have a negation. If somebody says there is God and I will do what he says, there is no negation of it in the religious sphere. There is simply that. There is only that. And any negation is kind of just immediately kind of negated itself. It's a negation of a negation, which is very, very Hegelian of Kierkegaard. But yeah.
Well, thank you for answering that. Mostly for me, what I love about Kierkegaard is often tools of persuasion, figuring out or attempting to figure out how to convince somebody of a certain idea or belief. And I do believe, to some regard, we are motivated by ego. Not many people experience an ego death or a sense of humbling themselves to opening themselves up to new or novel ideas. So rather than do that, Kierkegaard often used the system of evaluating one's own systems through internal monologues. and I wanted to get your, well, not it's not like a new emerging concept or idea from Kierkegaard, but I wanted your take and intrigue about, or at least your thoughts in general about that methodology that he sometimes used.
Yeah, so Kierkegaard, in a sense, is kind of what I would consider like the kind of modern day Socrates. With his ideas of adopting different pseudonyms in his books, he can kind of go around ruthlessly criticizing whoever he wants without the idea of anybody lashing back at him, because really they're just lashing back at a caricature of some point of view. In fact, Kierkegaard himself actually, even all the time in his works, admonishingly criticizes his own ideas. This kind of self-criticism that you find in Kierkegaard, where Kierkegaard is kind of using one of the characters of his books to admonish the characters of a different book, is quite common. In terms of rhetoric, of convincing people of a particular way of being, Kierkegaard probably doesn't speak about that as much as you would think. In a sense, Kierkegaard kind of wants to lay out our kind of existence as anxious beings, and then kind of leave it at that. He explains to us that the one of the ways out is the to be a knight of faith, to take that leap of faith. It is an escape from this anxiety, in a sense, although it is itself the most anxious thing we can do. But he doesn't really provide any kind of methodology of how we can do that. And I think it's because he himself recognizes that faith is not necessarily something that we can approach with a particular methodology. We can't simply just walk into a church and decide to have faith. It's not really a decision that's on our part. Whether or not this kind of is evidence of us being called to a religious or divine figure like God, or whether or not this is some subjective quality concerning the character or the moral character of the individual, he kind of leaves up to the reader to decide.
We spoke earlier about a lot of his philosophical methods and ideas in communication, but one aspect I want to touch on more is how does Kierkegaard's understanding of irony and humor contribute to this? What role does it have to play in his literary works?
So Kierkegaard, on one hand, is probably one of the most ironic, humorous people to read. He's constantly kind of pulling the wool over everyone, in a sense. But on the other hand, especially in his later works, he actually wants us to be deadly serious. And he even kind of provides a really quite brilliant criticism of irony or humor. He thinks that humor, for a lot of us, is kind of a coping mechanism that we use to kind of admonish that which is kind of having some sort of effect on us. He uses kind of more that he uses this more in reference to cynicism. So he talks about the cynical man and how the cynical man, in being so incredibly cynical, instead has to turn only on himself with his cynicism. So he has to kind of be cynical about himself, even being cynical. And it's kind of a really drab way to live, Kierkegaard thinks. If you're going around and you're kind of as like Socrates is doing, questioning everybody and pulling down their worldviews. On one hand, you're kind of maybe helping yourself with your own self-discovery, but it's actually not very conducive to the dialectic, he thinks. In fact, if you were to discuss the notion of a Socratic dialectic in reference to Kierkegaard, you would actually probably say that the Socratic dialectic is kind of worthless in a sense. It's not how you kind of come to truth, so to speak.
And does that pay homage to when he would say, damned if I do, damned if I don't? What did he mean in particular when he said that?
So that actually is a reference to our discussion of freedom. So the notion of regret is something that pervades anxiety. We regret our potential futures. And it seems that there is the situation that we are placed in where no matter what we do, we will regret it. So the exact quote is that, marry and you will regret that. Do not marry and you will regret that too. Marry or don't marry, you will regret it. So in a sense, we kind of are placed in a situation where we have to choose what to do in life. And regret comes with that no matter what. If we choose one thing, because that one thing is not the other thing, we will regret not doing the other thing. if we choose to do the other thing, well, we regret not doing the first thing. So no matter what we do, we can't really escape the capacity to regret our decisions. And in a sense, it actually, I believe, makes us truly responsible to take a very Sartrean approach. It is only through this recognition of that we are in control of our lives that we can kind of come to be responsible about everything. When we recognize that we are the ones kind of in control of what we believe, what we do, what morals and principles we adhere to, really we have regret, but really it's the only way to kind of live responsibly. In fact, I'd actually like to take a quick departure to discuss what I believe is probably one of the best ways to think about Kierkegaard. And it comes from a discussion that Sartre had with one of his students. So in World War II, a student came up to Sartre and asked him what he should do. He asked him, should I go off and fight the Germans and make very little difference in a very big project? Or should I stay home and take care of my mother and make all the difference in the world, but to only one individual? And Sartre said, no matter what you do, you're responsible. Like, if you choose to listen to me and my advice, well, because you are the one choosing to listen to me, you are responsible. If you go to your priest and you take your priest's advice, well, because you are the one choosing your priest's advice, you are responsible. Even if you were to go to God himself and ask for God's advice, because it is you choosing to abide or not abide by that advice, it is still you who are responsible, and you cannot escape this responsibility in a sense. So I think if you were to read that in a Kierkegaardian lens and kind of see why anxiety is kind of truly inescapable, I mean, it's only kind of through this kind of weird paradoxical quality where we use our freedom to kind of give up our freedom and surrender it to God that we kind of escape anxiety. But yeah, it's quite a strange notion.
I guess the follow-up question when we're talking about at the end of the day, it's always going to be your choice. What do you believe are the strengths and weaknesses for Kierkegaard's arguments almost in favor of free will is what it's sounding like? And correct me if I'm wrong, but would you not say Kierkegaard is doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. Kierkegaard is absolutely saying we have free will. And I think one of the strengths is that in some sense, Kierkegaard is kind of seemingly right that there must be some determinate factor concerning our decisions. And that determinate factor, at least as it appears, exists within us. One of the critiques you might have might be someone like Spinoza, who argues that really everything and everything really is kind of a part of the one thing. So the decision that you made to perform certain action isn't really your decision. It's kind of the decision of some greater power. But that goes more into the discussion of, I guess, maybe what you might think of as Calvinism, that kind of God kind of controls our ends in some sort of way.
Unfortunately, Calvinists are heretics, so maybe that would be a different discussion. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, it would be going a bit down Calvinist territory, but I understand that Kierkegaard had his own skeptical beliefs of the Holy Church, but I feel like that would be getting a bit off topic of his philosophy and more of his personal life.
Still, personal life,
but still, I'd see he's a brilliant man. No one could deny that.
No, definitely not. I think actually a really good example of Kierkegaard's personal life seeping into his work is that discussion of marry or not marry and you'll regret it. So Kierkegaard actually had a particular person whom he loved, and he courted her for many, many years. And then when he finally bolstered up the courage to kind of marry her, he decided not to. And he said, well, if I married you, I would regret it. And if I didn't marry you, I would regret that too. So in a sense, he kind of, in a really strange roundabout way, chose to not marry her as to lessen her regret on him. That's kind of a weird interpretation that, I think it was Sheffield, had about him. Yeah.
It's unfortunate too, because this may be my own personal philosophy seeping in, but I always see children to be the gateway for heaven and for beauty and purity, because that's what a child is at the end of the day. They're uncorrupted, and as they get older, the world corrupts them and tears them down. And I am curious of how different his philosophy would have been if he actually did marry her and did have many children, and have a deeper care or passion for someone more outside that is like a direct descendant of him or of his wife. That's something I'd find very interesting to think about.
I think so as well. I think a discussion concerning the how Kierkegaard's philosophy might have changed if he did marry and had kids, that would be a really good discussion. I would imagine his next couple books about responsibility would have been much more community-centered. So it wouldn't be just the responsibility of the individual and the responsibility they have of themselves, but the responsibility the individual also has to other individuals, which is relatively... It's there in Kierkegaard's work, but it's relatively lesser, I would say.
One last question for me, and we could bounce it over to Hazy, but we already mentioned a little bit earlier in regards to Kierkegaard's opinion of institutionalized religion, and I'd like to know your thoughts on how does Kierkegaard emphasize on the importance of the individual's relationship of God more than the institutional relationship of God from religion. What are your thoughts on that?
So specifically, the idea of an institutional religion, Kierkegaard would say, is squarely within the ethical sphere. It is not within the religious sphere, and it's because the ethical sphere contains things like the norms of and laws of man, in a sense. Kierkegaard thinks that the only kind of genuine, authentic relationship we can come to with the divine is going to be something incredibly personal. It's going to be something... wherein of my own free decision, I choose to kind of have God as my God. It's not going to be something that I can be born into and just kind of go along with. It's something that I specifically as an individual have to choose. It's not, as one might say, a view of culture. It's not that religion is a cultural product. It is very much a individual product.
Okay. Hazy, would you like to follow up with any other questions?
The biggest question, I think it was very interesting to talk about just religion in general, but in terms of the lack of identity, just to touch on something I said earlier in the conversation, I did bring up, not exactly that it was simply him using elements of persuasion, but it was more or less to get people to... get people to encourage that anxiety, to get them to ask these questions, and that there's a level of egotism that comes from having someone as personal as Kierkegaard, like, reprimand them about not living as earnestly as they possibly could, similar to Socrates' criticisms of people of living, like, an earnest and, faithful life to life that believes in principles. So, you know, that was what I was bringing up to. But also, I wanted to ask a question that seems to be a part of sometimes how people ask advice. And just as a fun question I wanted to ask, sometimes I believe that people more often than not are far more knowledgeable about their circumstances. With that in mind, sometimes I believe asking advice isn't asking for insight, rather it's trying to offshore the responsibility that comes with the decision that will be made. So I wanted to know your thoughts on that. Just a little...
So in a sense, this is probably more closer to Jean-Paul Sartre's work, this notion that when we ask people for advice, really what we're trying to do is run away from our responsibility. What Sartre would call bad faith. He literally says it's bad faith, in a sense. I think this is it is something which comes up a little bit in Kierkegaard, specifically in his The Concept of Anxiety. But it's not so much that the action of wanting advice isn't also it's not so much that the action of advice is only for running away from our responsibility. It can also be for mediation. Kierkegaard himself says it's fine to ask for advice if you just don't know about something and you're wanting to know about it. So, for example, if I was to say, Sola, what is the best burger to get when I'm in America or something like that? You know, that's fine. But if it's something concerning that which we both cannot have knowledge of, or if it's something concerning the ethical, something which we cannot objectively determine, but instead subjectively determine, so You know, solar, is it ethical if I sleep with my fan on at night? You know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? He can give me advice about it, sure, but the mediation of that advice is kind of limited in its capacity. It's not going to kind of bring me objective truth, Kierkegaard doesn't think.
I wanted to ask you, has there been any works that Kierkegaard published that you feel influenced you the most or that you find to be most intriguing?
Definitely Fear and Trembling. So Kierkegaard's discussion of Abraham and Abraham's kind of situation in Fear and Trembling, honestly has actually affected me quite personally. I think the discussion of how a person would react to, God asking something very ungodly of them, you know, God is supposed to be this wonderful being, who's supposed to only do good. And what do you do when God asks you to kind of do bad? That's something very hard to square with in my own experience. And I had always thought previously that a person who kind of did bad things in the name of God must have been under some sort of either misapprehension or was in some sense kind of evil. That they're not using their rationality properly. After reading Kierkegaard, I myself have kind of come to a agnostic position that if somebody has kind of a certain experience with God, there's not really a way that I can apply my own rationality or own reason onto it, not appropriately anyway. Rather, I kind of have to take some things in my life as being beyond my reason, and God and what God wants and what God desires and what God asks of us might be one of those things. It might just kind of be beyond my own capacity to know. And so instead, I kind of have to humble myself and admit that I'm in no position to kind of judge God in some sense, or that if I attempt to judge God, that comes with its own problems.
Agreed. And what is... Apologies, did I ask you this question earlier? What is your opinion on either or?
Either or, you didn't ask me what my opinion was on it. I think it's probably, it might be maybe my sixth favorite work of, probably either sixth or seventh. Really, Fear and Trembling is up there. Either or, I see as instrumental to the existentialist project. So this discussion of a philosophy of choice, of anxiety. But it's, if I am to be honest, I think it was written quite hastily. I think, Kierkegaard wrote it probably, I want to double check. It was either 18, yeah, I'll just quickly check either/or, when was it actually written? 1843. So it was a little bit earlier than I thought. I on one hand, I think it's fundamental to understanding the existentialist project, but I actually disagree a lot with what he discusses in it. So Kierkegaard, I think, in Either Or, wants to provide us with some account of what our situation is in respect to, in respect to philosophy. So what is it that philosophy is providing us? Is it providing us with the capacity to choose or to mediate choices? He doesn't think it is, and I actually disagree with that. I think that we actually can use philosophy to kind of ask how we should live, how we should, you know, be in the world. That's kind of a... I disagree with him for a particular number of reasons for that, and it would take me a lot to get into, though.
That was completely understandable. Hazy, would you have any other questions for Sudo?
No, this has been an exceptional conversation. In terms of... Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you, especially due to philosophers about Kierkegaard, what would be a person who influenced Kierkegaard in terms of readings and something, some literature that the artist can pick up? What would you recommend for some of the people that have influenced them?
Are you asking who what works of his I would recommend to somebody who wanted to get to know Kierkegaard?
Yes. Like a good entry point.
A good entry point would be the concept of anxiety. And from there, I would move to Fear and Trembling. The concept of anxiety is kind of probably, I think, Kierkegaard's easiest, maybe not easiest work. It's probably his most kind of basic work. Fear and Trembling, although it's written in a much simpler style, it's very easy to read, has some quite big ideas concerning it. This idea of a negation of a negation, this idea of a teleological suspension of the ethical, these are quite complex things. The concept of anxiety is quite simple, really, I believe.
All right. And would you like to leave us with any other, or ask us any questions we haven't brought up yet, or answer any?
I think one of the main questions that I sometimes get asked when talking about Kierkegaard is how he might relate to the future of existentialism. So for a very long time, existentialism has been rather secular or atheistic. This is very much in part of Jean-Paul Sartre's existentialism. Christian existentialism in particular has kind of
Gabriel
died
Marcel
off.
Is an example.
Yeah,
yeah. Thankfully, I'd say he's trying to make a revival of that, Gabriel Marcel, which I applaud him for. But yeah, it should be interesting to see where he goes with that.
Yeah. And I think that really a return to Kierkegaard is going to be something we'll actually see as a revival in philosophy in the next decade or so. Really, Kierkegaard's gotten a lot of popularity recently. And this idea of an existentialist Christian account has really garnered popularity in certain spheres.
Yeah, I hate to say this, but I'd have to give a little bit credit to Jordan Peterson there for bringing up Kierkegaard and Jung, a lot of the existentialist guys.
Yeah,
and that, like, that made it popular
agree with
again.
Peterson, he is right for doing that. Yeah, he's certainly...
I don't like agreeing with that guy. But yeah, there's me. You're going to hear it on the record. That's the one time I think I'll give that to Peterson.
Yeah, of course, of course. I think it's kind of needed now more than ever as well because of kind of the world we live in. We live in such an anxious world where we actually don't know what to do, that this notion that we can kind of still square our anxiety with the Christian faith is kind of like really quite appealing for Christians, I believe.
Yes, and that's what I really applaud Gabriel Marcel for doing, because he kind of asked that question where we live in a world where we became enlightened, we became reasonable, we reject these concepts of God, and look at where we are now. We are the most anxious we ever been, we're the most depressed we ever been. We have people challenging concepts that have been affirmed for thousands of years, you know, like men are men, women are women, and all of that's been thrown out the window and it's chaos. So Gabriel Marcel is pushing back on a lot of that from a different lens. That's, I would argue, is a bit unorthodox in Christianity, but definitely a unique spin and a refreshing dose on that for his quote-unquote cure ailment for society, which I hope he can make more of a breakdown. And I know I may be a bit biased here because I am a large fan of Marcel. I truly believe in the next 100, 200 years, he will be looked back and revered in the same light as these other heavy hitters in existentialism.
Yeah, I would think so too. I actually haven't read any works by Gabriel Marcel. I have read things about him concerning his opposition to Jean-Paul Sartre. I think I've read some of his plays back in the day. I do think he's going to certainly come to fruition in the next couple of years. That's for certain.
Yeah, because he did only die in the early 1970s, I believe. So he hasn't been gone for that long. And like I said, like a lot of his work is being a bit revived, which I feel is the same for the whole field of existentialism as well. Like a lot of, I've been seeing a lot more people who are Heideggerians than I've ever seen, say, you could say in like in the 90s or something. It's very refreshing to see a new spin for everyone trying to save us from this hellhole that we're living in today. But
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think currently, as I can think of off the top of my head, some of the very worst philosophers in the world, like people I would consider probably borderline evil as far as my own worldview can actually allow it, people like Zizek, Alexander Dugin, are Heideggerians. So yeah.
Yeah, I'd say Zizek's up there for being kind of evil, because it's just that man needs to get a fresh pair of shirts and wear deodorant, because it's disgusting listening to his lectures and seeing him covered in sweat.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he needs to stop rubbing his nose. He's pretty bad for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, the snort, rub nose, snort, rub nose. Yeah. I'm like, I'm going to go crazy if I have to see this anymore.
Yeah, but it's kind of a shame that like the legacy of Lacan was taken up by effectively probably one of the most unattractive people in philosophy, but oh well.
And I always joke about this, but I believe very deeply that ugly people tend to have ugly philosophies, and you could see this in Schopenhauer or in Sartre or in Foucault. They're very ugly individuals who preach a very disgusting message. And I'm always curious because, like, huh, you know, Kierkegaard is a very young and attractive man, and his portrayals, and obviously they weren't photographies, but they're still like drawings of him. I'm curious to think, and I'm a bit more optimistic in a lot of his work.
He was a short king, though. I think it was, I'll double check on, I'm pretty sure it was like 5'1" or something.
Yeah, he was very short. He was like 5'1", 5'2", which is funny. Yeah. Funny fact about Kierkegaard, too. One thing that was kind of an insecurity, but he routinely wore very high heels, which I thought was kind of hilarious because it was quote-unquote fashionable for men at the time. And it would just be him walking around. He's like obnoxiously high heels to give him a couple inches of height, basically. And it's not the traditional kind you see women wear today. It's like more of an older one. It's kind of a unisex one to wear, where it's like meant for, like, you know, yeah. What's up, Hazy?
And a question I'd like to ask you guys that I thought was worthwhile for both of y'all. This is for you and our guest today. I thought it was worth asking. In terms of a philosophical discourse, a back and forth between thought leaders in some regard, who would be the ideal individual you would want to see exchange ideas with Kierkegaard? Like, who would be the ideal philosopher you would want to see exchange and have a conversation, whether that be modern-day landscape or previous years gone by?
I would love to have seen a dialogue between Kierkegaard and Aquinas, or, strangely enough, Kierkegaard and Socrates. I think it would have been a very interesting notion to have somebody who is very, very critical of the Socratic dialogue, the Socratic method, actually kind of challenge Socrates, somebody who's been considered mostly beloved within philosophy. And I would also have been very keen to see how Aquinas would have actually reacted to Christian existentialism, how he would have reacted to this kind of Christ in a void, in a sense.
I'd say two people I'd be interested in seeing Kierkegaard have dialogue with. Well, Pseudo kind of stole the first one from me. What did I say? You know, St. Thomas Aquinas, of course, the doctor of the church. I'd love to see him go a couple rounds and, like, push Aquinas as far as he's capable of, and vice versa. But I'd also be interested in seeing Nietzsche go head-to-head with Kierkegaard, because while Nietzsche was influenced by Kierkegaard, especially in his, like, earlier works, he ultimately criticized, you know, Kierkegaard's Christian faith. And he always saw Kierkegaard as being a retreat from life, affirmation, the acceptance of suffering. So I would like to see the throwdown between the question of, can you break Kierkegaard? Like, can you break his faith? Because if you break his faith, you break his philosophy. If it stays standing, it stays standing. And in a weird way, I see, especially being as a Catholic, I have great admiration and respect for Nietzsche because he challenges a lot of my views. And I always say, if you are, as a Christian, able to read Nietzsche and come back out, you are going to be one of the most powerhouse, strongest Christians available, because he truly would put you to the test. And I'd like to see Kierkegaard being put to the test in his framework, especially without an institution backing him up, where it's just a 1v1.
I think a really interesting discussion between Nietzsche and Kierkegaard actually would be the somewhat corruptive nature of Christianity. So for Nietzsche, Christianity was seen as kind of like a kind of a weakness that corrupts other people to also being weak. But for Kierkegaard, this idea that Christianity can be a weakness is not necessarily founded. For him, it can actually be like the strongest source of faith. I mean, you can do seemingly impossible things with faith, Kierkegaard says. You can, in a way, kill your own son, the most beloved thing you have in the world, or at least be prepared to do so. So I would have really loved that, to have that discussion. I imagine Nietzsche would have said, well, anybody under the apprehension of a delusion can obviously do whatever they want. But I think it actually goes far beyond that, because it's not that we're given the idea that Abraham is delusional in the story. He actually is very sound of mind, and he's actually rationally trying to think about this.
He's terrified of the decision, too. That's another thing. Abraham is terrified, but he honors his Lord and puts faith and trusts in him. And that's something I find so beautiful about it.
Yeah, in a sense, I think even from my agnostic point of view, like Abraham kind of represents the strongest kind of person, because it's a person who does what they, what everything, what every bone in their body is telling them they shouldn't do, but they're gonna do it anyway because they know somehow deep down that it's the right thing to do, that no matter what, even if it seems like the worst possible thing to do, it is the right thing to do because, well, God told me it and I trust him.
Agreed. What about you, Hazy? Is there any interesting people you'd like to see Kierkegaard have discussions with?
Oh, you took mine already. Took Nietzsche. I
Nietzsche. Yeah. No, it's like a cycle, you know, pseudo tooks Aquinas, I take Nietzsche.
it. Seeing those two, Nietzsche is just somebody I think someone who is a very much a war and philosophy sort of individual, someone who's a very much kind of very much hostile and antagonistic to like faith and all that. And so it would have been a good conversation to like have seen these two people interact with one another. But yes, both of your questions, both of y'all, you took my pick with Socrates, because I think, which is why I began this conversation with Strand about Socrates and how that may have influenced him. And I love Nietzsche's work as well. So I wanted to hear both of your answers about the topic. But thank you. Thank you for the answers.
Out of curiosity, actually, just before we move on, how do have any of you either read any of Kierkegaard's work?
Yes, I actually have a copy of me right now of Either Or. I was skimming through looking for things for questions while we were speaking, because
Yeah,
I've
yeah.
read Either Or and a couple of his other works. He was definitely, I'd argue, someone who brought me back from the depths of atheism when I was at my lowest and brought me to the state of agnosticism. And Aquinas put the nail in the head for me and brought me back to the faith of like Christianity and the Holy Church. So I have a very deep respect for Kierkegaard in doing that.
What about you, Hazy? Have you had much contact with Kierkegaard or his works at all?
Most of the things I've mostly consumed has just been the books written by like his alter egos, which is just kind of like an attack. Or actually, there was it name escapes me right now, but he's basically combating himself within this writing, and he's basically getting to the conclusion of how someone gets to faith. But he creates an like an almost polar opposite version of himself, and the combativeness of this literature is to show in the conclusion of how to reach God. And I
That's what I
cannot
just
think of
brought
it
up.
because
That's either or what you're describing, where it's two individuals going back and
I'm gonna
forth.
say either or sickness unto death.
So was, but for me, for the most part, I just been enjoying that's mostly primarily what I've been reading mostly for light reading purposes. But yeah, that's primarily what I've been going off of.
I think he's a very nice philosopher in that you can just do light reading of Kierkegaard. Other philosophers, especially during his time with people like Hegel, Schopenhauer, Kant, Schleiermacher, Schelling, Fichte, you actually need like a really big understanding of their system to understand what they're even saying. But Kierkegaard's very simple, and I really appreciate that. And I wish personally, for, as an academic point of view, we could go back to just the simple writing philosophy. This systemization in philosophy, although it's lovely, can be absolutely infuriating for somebody who wants to actually learn, somebody coming as a newcomer, so to speak.
Speaking on academia and Kierkegaard, are there any philosophers or writers today that are still alive that are currently writing about Kierkegaard? Any people commentating on any of his work?
I'm sure there would be. I don't know at the moment. I don't know their names. There would absolutely be a very large people. Number of people out there writing about Kierkegaard. I would imagine a lot of existentialists. Existentialism, like I said before, is kind of moving away from the atheistic secular existentialism and is discussing the nature of the divine a lot more in more recent works. But yeah, I don't know of any specific individuals, no.
All right. And some of my final questions for you. What do you wish to see in the future in regards for Kierkegaard on the world? If you could tell the world to adopt any of his like writings, what would you like to see?
I would like to see a recognition of Kierkegaard's discussion of angst or anguish, I think that people understanding the nature of anxiety, that anxiety is not about any particular thing, but rather it is about or concerns the kind of nothingness of not nothingness in a literal sense, rather the plethora of multiple different outcomes that we can come to manifest ourselves. I would like to see that recognized by more people. When people recognize that they are kind of in control of their lives, I think it places responsibility back into their hands, and people with responsibility in their hands will think twice about doing what I would consider to be bad acts. So I think Kierkegaard, if read by people, can help them become more responsible.
All right, thank you very much. Hazy, would you like to have any closing comments for us?
And in this entire conversation, I think it's been very insightful for the audience. I've enjoyed this conversation. I've appreciated our guests to come on. And I think you've given them a lot of homework, as well as given them a better understanding of, you know, gave them a glance into the philosophical world and basically the inner workings of his mind to some degree. It wasn't just simply a reiteration of his just his history as is. You really delved into the topic, and I appreciate that from you. And I appreciate this conversation that was brought about by it.
Yeah, thanks, Izzy.
Yeah, one more time, thank you again so much for being on our show, Pseudo. It's been a really enjoyable experience. And for people who don't know, Pseudo, would you like to include any of your social media for people to follow you at or to sure. learn more about what you're doing?
So you can just find me on Twitter at Pseudomastics. There's not really any social medias I have. I don't have Instagram or anything else. Pretty much just Twitter/X. So if you guys want to follow me there or talk a bit to me or send me a message, I'm always up for any kind of discussion pretty much. So yeah.
Would you mind spelling that out for us?
Sure. Pseudomastix. Pseudomastics.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, that would be all for our podcast for today. Thank you all for tuning in to Rec Room Radio, and I hope you have a good rest of your day. Have a good one.